It's good to be with you all. So I had this idea on retreat just to explore this whole thing about the story of me, because when you look at what goes on in our practice, for a lot of us, that's what goes on a lot of the time. We're telling ourselves the story of me and reviewing and going back in the past and all of that. So it's one way to look at not self, one way to look at mindfulness. So I thought we could explore that a little bit, because that I know for a lot of people that's kind of like number one distraction is telling ourselves the story of me over and over again. And we take one little arising and it just goes into this big papancha. And the more we can kind of understand what's going on, it can help us work with it. It's not bad, but if it invades our mindfulness or we're completely sucked away, then we're not, practicing so much. We're just having a daydream in that period. So the more we can work with it and bring it into our practice and use it as a tool to be present, then that's a plus. And it's also really helps us see our selfing, because if you get right down to it, we're basically convinced we're at the center of the universe, and we're trying to stretch past that, but that's kind of our default. And so, if that's the case in our sort of emotional self, then of course all the stories pivot around us. I know for if you ever had any interesting feedback, if when we have recollections of the past, and we think we're remembering something concrete that happened, and then it becomes really clear we're just looking at our own personal little window of some phenomena that happened, that there's nobody else in the world that would remember that the way we remember it anyway, especially as it has to do with relationships. But it's just kind of hilarious how much, that which we think is a memory is completely a product of our experience and our perspective. And that whole papancha thing can be pretty funny. I mean, a thought arises about ducks, and then 5 minutes later, we're remembering being in the duck boats in Boston Commons when a relationship was falling apart and that was the end of it, right? Or sometimes if we're working something out with something, or we got to work or the problem and some possible person and the thing we need to say, and we're rehearsing it and rehearsing it and rehearsing it and rehearsing it 10 times over. So just to watch all that go on, but you can see how much it is all running around myself, or all of our myselves. And the more we can kind of work with that, it's really helpful. And that constricted sort of selfing, it's far from not self. But because it's so far, it's almost a way to start to see not self, if we can actually catch what's going on while it's going on. And it's just, that's what the mind does. It creates thoughts and then it associates them. And that happens in realized beings, in arhats. They do that too. But they don't get lost in it. I mean, that's the big difference. We get lost in it and they don't. So how we navigate that power of ourselves, in the five skandhas, the fourth one is mental processing, and that's just what we do. But it doesn't mean it's us, and it doesn't mean how it goes has to be defining. So the big difference is how much we believe in the story of me. And I was struck when Ajahn Jundi was here. He had this, and I got to be a little around him a little bit at Ladawan's place, this Thai couple where these guys stay. And he just had this amazing sense of just being present in this incredible, simple, lovely sort of happiness. But you could just see there wasn't a lot of kind of proliferating going on. He probably couldn't, he sort of wasn't erotic about it. He was just there. It was amazing. And but us, or myself, we're often, we may be looking like we're cross-legged and we're just in this really funny spiral. So I just want to spend a little time exploring that and maybe some ideas about how to free ourselves from it and then see, what that generates for you all. Because, you know, in terms of dukkha, suffering in life, a key problem is we seek satisfaction in that which cannot offer it. That's like our problem, or as unawakened beings, that's the issue. And I can remember when I was, they call it junior high school in Connecticut, but when I was, I don't know how old I was, 12 or something, crashing through, I sort of woke up to the fact that all the adults around me were neurotic messes, basically. You know, and they had all this stuff going on that was patterned and from the past, and they were acting out. They were acting in weird ways because of patterns that they weren't able to free themselves from, or they didn't even see. It was quite startling because, you know, as an innocent child, you sort of don't see that. And then suddenly I saw it, and that was a big inspiration about, it was sort of one of the launch pads of my sense of the spiritual path, is like, there's got to be a way out of this. You know, there's got to be a way to get down to the bottom underneath all of that compulsiveness that strings us out into all kinds of thought patterns, but it's all conditioned. Like, how do we get through it? So when I found meditation years later, it was like, oh yeah, that's the way. That's the way. And part of what I love about the Dharma is the non-concretization, the underlying understanding that any phenomena is made in a sense of self. It's all made of parts. It has causes and conditions. It can be seen through. We can be mindful of all those parts, and in that very complexity, realize there's no inherent anything there and find freedom in it. I just love that about the Dharma. It just inherently looks through the tangles and at the same time acknowledges our complexities. I mean, in practice, we sort of inevitably have to come up against everything. I mean, we see everything, right? There's nothing hidden. But in the very act of seeing it mindfully, we can start to get through it. And this unique, you know, the unique understanding of the lack of inherent existence, that is the most unique thing, the core of what makes Buddha Dharma different from theistic traditions. And it's, you know, in Mahayana, it's called emptiness, referring to all phenomena. And Theravada is more of an emphasis on our personal, not self, emptiness. So it's anatta. But it's the same thing. It just has a slightly different kind of sphere of focus. And the Buddha taught about emptiness, and Mahayana teachers teach about not self all the time. So it's not like exclusive. It's just kind of an emphasis. And I started off in Mahayana for many years. But there's a way in which the anatta viewpoint emphasis of Theravada is so useful, because that's where we mostly do our work. The whole idea of emptiness can be, I mean, it's not theoretical, but it's not close to the heart. But anatta and how we work with our stuff, that's close to the heart. And it's hard to actually to see anatta in the middle of daily life, and we trip up on our attachments, our patterns, our stickiness. We trip up constantly, but to keep doing the work is amazing. And our underlying clinging to self and pleasant phenomena, that it's always going on. It's underlying. And to start to be able to really see it and work with it and see through it slowly, slowly, it's pretty cool. But the very insight we're seeing, wanting to be able to have insight about the nature of reality, or to see emptiness, put it another way, it comes right smack up against our complications and our neuroses and our patterns and traumas and identifications in the ways that we are really adhered to, you know, our sense of self and where we think we're important or something, or identify with what we do, where we dislike something about ourselves and want to push it away. So to right in that gritty area, it's so amazing. It's where we do our work. And storytelling, which comes up in practice, is a way that this really manifests. Because when we're telling the story of ourselves to ourselves, and we catch ourselves doing that in practice, it's everyone's stories or collection of stories are unique to them, a product of who they are, of their lifetime or lifetimes of conditioning. And so to really be able to work with that is pretty amazing. And as the more we look toward insight, we can start to kind of find out how to work with this storytelling phenomenon, not so much as a problem, but as a doorway to insight. It's revealing ways, and there's ways in which we can work with it to help get free. And how we get there, if we think about how we grow up, like look at a 2-year-old, a little 2-year-old child. That's where the terrible twos, right? So they get angry when they're something they don't want, when they're lost, they feel pain, they want to get food and it's not happening, whatever. They're starting to like find themselves as individuals, and they're navigating this strange world where other people have all this power, and it's difficult. And then, as we grow older, we start to try to make sense of what's frustrating, what's not meeting our needs, and we come up with all kinds of different stories and understandings about it. And then also, we may be, depending on our situation, there may be bad, we may have parents with problems. We may have difficult situations. Even apart from that, traumas. I mean, little kids are traumatized early on, and then they have to make sense of it in their lives. And it carries over in strange ways. And you see people acting out and doing things that have roots way back there, and they tell these stories to themselves, way in the secret little parts of their lives about who I am and why I'm inherently messed up and all that. There are studies, I looked it up, but more than half of young children believe they're somehow to blame if their parents are in massive conflict or if there's a divorce, if their parents get divorced. More than half of young children think it's their fault somehow, because they're trying to make sense of it. And that's sort of what they come up with. And then they end up with this whole storyline in their hearts that, they got to do therapy, practice, whatever they do to unwind it, because it's not true that that was their fault. And so we don't know, what kinds of things are in us. I say all this because the ways that we get caught up in Popancha and go spinning off are so much a reflection of all of our patterning. And in some ways, it's a revealing what our causes and conditions are. So we can kind of like almost approach it in a more embracing sort of way, and it's helpful rather than a problem. And I don't know, I mean, I certainly hear that people in Dharma countries like Thailand, I mean, kids are certainly Tibetan. When I've, this is secondhand, this is hearsay, this was from reading in a pre-Chinese invasion kind of Tibet. But kids grew up pretty happy. And, a lot of people from those cultures are kind of amazed at our levels of psychological complication. They just grew up, and maybe that was because of the Dharma. Part of me, I think you could make a case, because if there are some sense of causes and conditions in the families, and they don't hold things so tight, and they're able to just give more simple love without a lot of tangles, and the kids grow up that way. I don't know. Something I was thinking, what was it? Oh yeah, there's this famous thing when the Dalai Lama, remember those Mind and Life conferences they used to do? I don't know if they do that anymore, but from way back in the 80s and 90s, there was amazing Mind and Life conferences, and they'd have neuroscientists and psychologists and all kinds of heavy-duty Western scholars go to Dharamsala and gather with some of the highest lamas and the Dalai Lama, and they'd have these conferences about things like the psychology of suffering and help and the neuroscience. But I think there was one moment when someone says something about how most Westerners really don't like themselves. And, so many have bad views of themselves. And the Dalai Lama like just couldn't get it. He said, wait, what are you saying? And they had to explain it to him 2 or 3 times, and it just didn't He just couldn't get it on a certain level. It was pretty amazing. And I think it's partly because, he understands that these are just conditions and we think that's me who screwed up irreparably. That so many people walk around like that. That's what they think. It's so sad. But that's part of what the journey is here, because the whole idea of a person being intrinsically flawed is in our culture. But in the Dharma, we can see the conditions but not think that's anything intrinsic. It's just conditions. And how we tell stories to ourselves is kind of a like a doorway, an avenue to unwinding that. And storytelling, it's how we make sense of things. Like in indigenous cultures, if you look at, they're constantly telling stories in their histories of their time, all the stories about, like a Native American stories about how creation happened are all, different, but they're stories, 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 stories. And the Bible's full of stories. The suttas are full of stories, just stories with a beginning and an end with people in them. That's how we understand life a lot. So it's no surprise that in our own world, when we're trying to find solutions, even subconsciously, we'll tell stories. Like when we're trying to figure out what we're going to say to our difficult boss, we'll tell the story, we'll rehearse it over and over, we'll walk the walk on the door in our minds. I've done that anyway. I know if you all have, but I think we all do. And one of the key elements to start to cut through this and see through it is the whole question of time. It's such an important part of how we navigate our Dharma practice, because stories, the very nature, they either have to do with the past or the future. They have to do with memory and pulling up memory and reconcocting it and replaying it, or they have to do with the future where we haven't gotten yet and making up stories about. And we sort of think it's happening. When we're in it, lost in it, it feels like that is now, but it's not. This now is. These momentary nows, all those things are past and future. And the more we can really take that in, it's a real important part of practice to just keep refreshing ourselves that this is just happening in this moment. And so, if we're in a meditation session in the morning and our prapancha pulls us off and, we're doing our 12th story of the sit or fourth or however it goes, but to keep go, oh yeah, it's happening right now. And just remind ourselves of that. It's really powerful. And then you can really see it for what it is rather than being in it, rather than being identified with it. And in terms of, how we work with that, I mean, the core thing is our mindfulness practice. That's how we effectively work with any kind of arisings that are compounded, that have causes and conditions that aren't just awareness in the present. We bring them into our practice and see how we can see through it. And the Buddha, he did talk about his past. It's not saying we don't talk about our past. He did. In the suttas, he has, on occasion, these very interesting descriptions of how he practiced when he was young, how he practiced when he was an ascetic, the rose apple tree, how he grew up. So it's not like we don't remember that stuff. We just don't get lost in it and identify with it. And think it's actually happening right now. Because he was always right here. He just, like all of us, he could do that. So, one powerful way to disempower storytelling is just to keep pulling ourselves back into the present, just reminding ourselves we're already in the present. We just forgot. But also, how mindfulness helps us see through our sense of self. That's right, getting at the core, because the story's all about thinking that there is a self. All those stories, it's not about not self, it's about thinking there is a self is why they have so much grip on us. So it's really a time to work our practice to start to see through that, right in the rub of what's in our face. That's an opportunity to kind of keep taking apart our sense of inherent self that so bedevils us. Because ultimately, without a self, there's nothing to tell a story about that would grab us. Without, we have a conventional self, but without an ultimate self, without an inherent self. So the tools of mindfulness, you know, four foundations are really helpful. And so it's really, I just find they apply all over the place. Like, you know, if we're finding ourselves spinning out on something, first bring ourselves back to the body. You know, what are we feeling in the body that might have triggered our storyline in this way? It could be a physical wound that we're feeling, you know, some that brings up a memory, or it could be a, you know, a little emotional taste, a recollection that brings up a certain feeling that brings up a story. Or it could be a regret that has a real tactile. I'm really prone to regrets, you know, spiritual possibilities I missed. That's like my big one. And I feel all this angst, and I can, this gotten so familiar. It's like, oh yeah, you know, and I can kind of recognize it when it comes up to where I feel it. And just being mindful of the physical part can help not be attached to it or not cling to it, because I can see how much of the clinging has to do with the physical experience that I'm having, that I'm used to. So to really scan the body, see where we're feeling it. You know, when there's a compulsive storyline popping up, just scan the body and see where you're feeling it. And it may well be there's some real familiar conditioned experience that you've had for decades. And when that sucker lights up again, then you go down that avenue. And if you can, the more you can see it, then it just takes the claws out of it. And then Vedanas, you know, that's so important, pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, that second foundation, because that's sort of, when you really start to look at it, that's driving most stories. It's usually either something pleasant that we wish we could have had, but we didn't, or something unpleasant that we wish hadn't happened, and it did, or in the future, you know, something that we hope will happen, but it might not, or we fear is going to happen. All that, but it's to really keep bringing it back in terms of the Vedanas and look at pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. Just so kind of like, oh yeah, wait, let me check on the second foundation. What's going on here? And it can really help us see how compulsive these are. And the third foundation is, you know, it's kind of similar. Those tones of mind, which aren't, you know, Vedanas are more like, it has to do with contact, you know, something from one of the six sense doors, we contact it and we have a Vedana reaction. The third foundation is more like states of mind that we're just walking around in, and we sort of don't know who we are because we're lost in them. And to really be able to, in the middle of the story, kind of pull up, just look at that, because a lot of times there's some mental tone that we are prone to walking around in a lot of the time because of some conditioning. You know, some sense of pervasive sadness or longing or discontent, all those kind of things. And just to be able to see it, oh yeah, that has causes and conditions. That's not inherently me. It is some part of my conditioning. And the more we can just be mindful of it as it happens, then it kind of starts to, it's like the stories that when they pop up, I often look, it's almost like a canary in a coal mine, you know? It's like, whoop, story happening. What's cooking behind that? And it's a time to just kind of settle in and take a look. So we don't have to like fight the story so much, but use it to look and see what we see, see how it unpacks. And then in particular, because some of you know the fourth foundation has five lists in it, and the third of those lists, to make this ridiculous, has five things in it, but the five khandhas, that's from a Buddhist point of view, that's what makes up our sense of self. And to scan across those can be really helpful. You know, as body and Vedanas comes up again, body Vedanas, perception, mental formations, and consciousness, and to kind of scan across those and see where we're concretizing around this storytelling. You know, it might be a real vivid recollection of a perception. And the one we tend to identify most with is consciousness of something we think, it's got to be me being conscious. So we kind of lock into that. But just to use that as a tool, I mean, it's pretty brilliant. The more you look at the khandhas, how much they actually do. Seems like the Buddha nailed it in my own sense of things. You all might disagree, but it seems like he really covered that which makes up our sense of self. So it's just, I find it just handy. It's like just to pull some of these things up like out of a toolbox and just, you know, have a little moment of investigation in the middle of your mindfulness and just see, you know, what's going on, and then you can bring mindfulness to it. But it helps us just not be kind of lost in a muddle that has us just spinning out in stories constantly. If you're prone to that, some of you may not be, but I bet most of you are, some of the time anyway, in your practice, in your practice moments. And the more we can, you know, again, because of sort of the bugaboo in this whole business is having a concrete sense of self, that we believe in these things, we think it's me, and we're stuck. So working with the skandhas can really help it start to come apart into its component parts, and they can be very freeing. And then lastly, two other, you know, areas of practice that are actually, they help diminish the concreteness of selfing and therefore help free us from storytelling, is kindness and ethics. Just those simple kindness and ethics, which in this, when you look at it this way, they're almost the same. I mean, kindness is about wishing for the welfare of beings, and ethics is about not doing that would harm other beings. So they're, you know, two sides of the same coin. But when what they do, the more we act with those, is they thin our sense of self. Because if you look at violation is the wrong word, but an unethical action, that's almost always someone putting themselves ahead of someone else. They want the bigger piece of pie. They want the gold bullion from the back of the truck, where that came from. But, you know, whatever it is they do that's unethical, they're putting themselves first, and you can see someone's self just hardening up in that. I mean, that's just an ethical, a bad ethical action, a negative action, is just makes someone concretized. Whereas kindness just has this open, non-identifying opening to it. And so it's they're really worth looking at how these intersect with this whole area of our complications and our selfing, and how our attachment to an inherent sense of self causes neurotic messes. One of the Devan at the retreat, she has this great book. She and her husband, who are like incredibly intense practitioners that do like 4-month retreats solo. And like, I think she was in a cabin, he was in a tent up in the mountains above Ashland in the snow. They're extraordinary. And they did a book called How to Not Be a Hot Sticky Mess. Isn't that great? How to Not Be a Hot Sticky Mess. It's a great little book. So this stuff is freeing, but ethics and kindness are really supportive of how our mindfulness helps us see clearly. So worth cultivating. And you think about, you know, without naming any names, persons in power with enormous amounts of wealth and power, and what they're up to in the world. Name your favorite despot. It's just the opposite. You know, they're just pulling power to themselves, and they have an enormous sense of concreteness about themselves. Not self is the last thing on their minds, which I guess can kind of work if you keep winning, sort of, but not really. But we can go the other way. Thank you very much. And where this takes us, in the refrain of the Satipatthana Sutta, he says, one abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. It's this great, strange, little, simple thing. Independent, not clinging to anything in the world. This wonderful way of looking what awakening is. But in a way, that's where all this takes us. You know, the more we can see through the stories we tell ourselves, which means see through the ways we're identified with all these conditions, we get closer and closer to being independent, not clinging to anything in the world. So, you know, when next time you practice and story time comes, you know, just take a look and see how you can work with it and see what an opportunity it is. Let's sit for a minute.